how does energy, how do materials in general travel throughout the food chain and food web? We'll look at those. If it's casein 7 and loses 3 units of phosphorus, which is a very tougher source to get, how much does it have left? 4, right? We know that energy cannot be created or destroyed. That's the very first law of thermodynamics. We've talked about thermodynamics a couple of times. We've talked about this physics. Matter and energy cannot be created or destroyed. It can simply be transferred. We can't get something from nothing. We have to have a way of getting a hold of these resources. If we cannot just create energy, how are we going to get our energy? Where do we get it from? Generally, the sun. We will see that there are species that live in areas where there are absolutely no sun. Okay? These species live in deep ocean trenches where they never get sunlight. How do they survive down there? They actually use the heat. Okay? They use the sulfur vents to do a different type of respiration. Okay? To change how they build their sugars and how they actually feed themselves. There's an entire ecosystem based off of these, okay? These deep depth situations. But what we're going to focus on are what we will likely encounter in our lives. Ecosystems based off of energy flow from the sun. So, a cheetah eats 10,000 calories from antelopes in a week, okay? And it burns 3,000, okay? So it ate 10,000, burns 3,000. What's left? What's left? And it gets, so it's got 7,000 left. 500 calories go towards actually building up, okay? Actually becoming larger, okay? Whether that's repairing or getting more muscle, more bone, etc. 3,500 calories go in one way or another to the cheetah. Where's that other 6,500 going to? We know. We've seen it before. Heat. Remember, nothing's 100% efficient. Animals going at about 33%, that's about as good as it gets when it comes to energy transfers, okay?
About 33% is about as good as it gets,
okay? And we only see about a very small amount of that huge caloric intake actually transferring over to the cheetah, in this case about 5%, okay? Heat, entropy, okay? That natural second law of thermodynamics, okay? Okay, when it comes to, as we looked at before, your car, okay? This is the second time I'm talking about this, so I'm probably going to ask it again, right? Think about the car. Why does your car heat up when you drive everywhere? It's warming up because the majority of the energy that's released when it's propelling itself is actually going out as heat. You're heating that car up. You're heating that engine block up, okay? All that energy could have been used to propel the car. It's not. No. Most of it's going out of heat. Same thing happens with the cheetah. Same thing happens with us. We don't make perfect transfers of energy. So how does that translate into a college? I'll talk about me a little later. Excellent. Okay. But we'll go through this whole setup first. Okay. You have a generic ecosystem. Okay. A very simple food chain, one leading to another, leading to another, okay? We've got grassland, got the antelope, okay? The grass is getting 100 units of energy from the sun, okay? We're going to say 100 units of the energy the sun is passing down are transferred into the grass. The grass is able to photosynthesize and make that much sugar. How much does this gazelle get out of all that? When that gazelle eats the grass, how much energy does it end up with? Only 10%. Only 10 units transfer, okay? These are rough estimates, okay? So it could be 12, it could be 8, alright? There's a little bit of fluctuation. But in ecosystems, there's the 10% rule. Maybe you can say that. This guy's wrong. 10% rule. As we go up in trophic levels, trophic means feeding levels, okay? As we go up in feeding levels, you only transfer about 10% of the energy, okay? Where's all that other energy going?
Either it's you running or it's heat, okay? One of the two.
It's you using it to stay up or it's heat. Most of it, the vast majority, almost 70%. So as we go up in these feeding levels,
we only get 10% and 10% and 10% more.
So the further away from the grass you are, how does that translate?
The further away from the grass, the less energy you're getting.
So that's why it's rare to have big, fierce animals. It's more difficult to support them.
Okay? There has to be more energy available.
In a hotter overall ecosystem, there would be. But energy flowing up, all right? Energy flowing up, you only end up getting in the top of the food chain a very, very small amount compared, right? And oftentimes, you do not have predators that prey on other predators. Predators will oftentimes prey on consumers. We'll talk about primary consumers in a second. So, the 10% rule, remember the 10% rule. I will likely reference it, all right? Only 10% goes up to the next level. That's why you don't have lots and lots of big carnivores. Even when large carnivores are present and succeed, you have a very limited number of them, right?
Those top predators, right? Top of the food chain, okay? Those have to have a large volume of prey items. They have to be able to get lots and lots of prey
because they're getting less energy per item that they're ingesting. So what does this imply about world hunger? Which diet would be the most energy efficient for humans? Beef? We just eat a whole lot of beef. Milk? We don't kill the cow, we get a lot more protein. Or vegetarian? Which is probably the most efficient diet? Vegetarian. Why? Because there's no trophic level to go up.
Okay?
We end up taking from the 10% rather than the 1%.
Right?
Because we start off with grass. Yeah, yeah. Get ready for it. Boy, that's the worst cow ever. We could have a cow. We could have a cow eating that grass, and then a person eating the cow, the grass, the cow, the person, that's the cow eating me, the grass, the cow, the person, how much does this person get if this is 100%? Cow gets 10, person gets 1. If instead we go grass, person, how much would he get? More efficient. That's even worse. Poor cow left in the dark. Alright? Don't eat him. So you should actually get more energy through a vegetarian diet. Are we designed to go with just a singular vegetarian diet? No.
We would have to supplement that diet because we are omnivores.
We're not necessarily designed to eat huge amounts of protein, but there are proteins that we don't particularly make. Okay, we have to get from our food. It's important to make sure we get them.
That's why it can be very, very difficult to be a vegan. Okay, being a vegetarian and being a vegan, much different, right? Vegan, nothing from an animal. A vegetarian, you can have some things from an animal, like milk and cheese, right? But you can't, if you're a vegan, can't have anything more than that. Let's think about what we're eating when we eat meat. Okay, think about what we've got when we're breaking down the meat. What all's there? Protein? Fat, some sugar, not much sugar. Plants. Why can't we get as much energy from certain plants?
We can't properly break down all the carbon that's there.
Okay. A cow has a ruminating gut, so it can eat that grass, ferment it, and get a whole lot of energy from it. Okay. We cannot do that. So when we look at that grass, we see it as having very few calories because we're talking about what we can attain. Okay. Now there are plenty. Think about fruits. That have plenty of those things that have huge amounts of energy, right? We look at baked potatoes, right? Basically just sugar, right? That big white potato was just sugar. And it had way more energy, way, way more energy than any meat, right? Unless you were eating basically pure fat of the same weight. But overall, at the same volume, that one should have, based off of what you should be getting out of a real
ecological situation. Now, you can grow cows to have more fat on them, but that's not how they would really be in nature.
But you're still not transferring as much as you would like because
you have to grow that whole cow. Think about how long it takes for that cow to become an adult, okay? You're investing energy that whole time, okay? A lot of that energy is going to build that cow. You can only get so much of that energy back out, okay? That's where we're getting the 1% at, okay? So basically, we would bypass the middleman when it came down to it. So we would have to invest less overall resource, overall energy coming in. Okay? Is it possible to have just an, an only vegetarian diet? Not really. We would have to have some other situation going on, right? Hopefully not soil and green. But some other way of obtaining protein. It's Charlton Heston. The classic. Okay, so how we've been referring to these things, we've been talking about food chain, right? It's a chain. Step one, to step two, to step three. Okay, one leads to another, leads to another. The food web is more realistic. It would go to the cow, it'd go to us, and it'd go from the cow to us, right? So we'd also get 1% from here, okay? That's a food web, all right? All these things are interacting. So we see more complex interactions with the ecological system. Here is a trophic feeding level, a small cascade. Okay, we see large fish eating small fish, eating these small herbivores that are eating these small algae. The small algae are taking in CO2, taking in sunlight, and taking in nutrients. Okay, they're making energy via photosynthesis. Okay, these smaller herbivores, we have tons and tons of these little krill and plankton and whatnot living in water, eat these little algae. Small fish eat these little herbivores. Big fish eat these guys. So here's 110, less than 1%. So the big fish has to eat more, okay? Less energy is going to flow up there. Think about some of the big aquatic animals. Really, really big aquatic animal, the whale. What does the whale eat? It's a filter feeder. It eats krill, right? It's going right after the herbivores, okay? It's not trying to eat any of these small fish. It's trying to get the 10%ers so that it can be a little bit bigger, okay? Here's an Arctic food web. The baleen whales will eat a lot of stuff, lots and lots of stuff. But when we come right down to it, we get down to invertebrates, krill, and crustaceans, the little guys, are what everything seems to feed on at the end, okay? We see at the top, there are cheaters. We've got birds. They're not necessarily scavengers. What they're doing is they're making it so that the other animals can't hurt them back, right? Remember what we saw that bird doing to the goat? Birds, aquatic birds, or birds that go over the ocean,
they snipe the fish out. They don't give the fish a chance to go after them, okay?
So they're cheating. They're protecting them. The killer whale is really the top here. It will go after and kill any of these other species, okay? It'll leave pretty much anybody on the list, all right? It usually doesn't eat large baleen whales. It usually only eats small baleen. There are videos of that. Heart seals, small seals, all that. There's plenty of stuff about that all. But the killer whale, would it eat a bird if it could? Sure. Does it get the opportunity? No. Why doesn't it get the opportunity? The bird doesn't get the opportunity. It stays in the air, right?
They jump out from around, and then when they start chasing us, they'll funnel them
just
up. They, yeah. I said it was bigger than the boat.
The fish
is bigger than the boat. Like, it
came
straight up over his. I think he would come all the way
up
the top of the water and just open his mouth.
Yeah. makes you think about jumping off the boat and swimming, right? That's certainly what will happen. We see some really interesting, really, really interesting behavior in sharks. Sharks going in, great whites going at full speed after a prey item, they will literally jump out of the water. Really, really neat to watch. Definitely one of those videos that if you feel like looking up some videos, sharks doing that. The shark jumping, not jumping the shark, right? We're not the fawn. The shark jumping, that's what you want to see. It's pretty cool. Great whites will definitely go after food items moving quickly like that. Pretty much. But yeah, I mean, the ocean isn't, it's a pretty interesting place. There's a lot of stuff going on.
It's always been one of those big kind of battleground areas all throughout history. We're just kind of overfishing it right now and
taking away most of that whole dynamicness, causing some interesting issues as some of those bigger predators start looking for new sources of food. They don't really come after us so much, but some of the smaller otter invertebrates have started to become a big issue for us because of global warming. I'll put something about that. We've been thinking about putting that in. I probably should have. The new jellyfish stuff. Absolutely. Pelicans are now starting to go after other nests, and eating the eggs of smaller birds. Not a behavior we saw them do ever before, but in the past few years they started doing it. A global trend in increased temperature. A few more turns to now in the food web before we get too far, because we're going to come back to that in this lecture. So let me go forward a bit. We've got producers, okay? These are mostly plants. They're converting light into chemical energy, okay?
These are the 100%, right? They're the ones who are getting energy from the sun. Now, realize that they're getting 100% out of
the sun sending down 1,000, right? They're only getting 10% of what's really coming in. So when I say they're 100%ers, I just mean they're the start of what we're going to talk about when we talk about the web sort of chain, okay? Herbivores, primary consumers, they're plant eaters. They eat plants. Most of us know what herbivores are. Carnivores, flesh eaters, they mostly eat other animals. Decomposers, they do something really, really important. They return elements bound in organisms to the soil where they are recycled. These decomposers aren't actually killing the animals, okay? They're happening upon dead animals. These are kind of scavengers, okay? And they're breaking them down chemically, okay?
Extremely important. Decomposers are one of the most important parts of the food chain or web. Without them, the chain, the web, it doesn't go on. Once this stuff, once these elements, once these resources are locked up, if you don't have a decomposer, they don't get unlocked. You can't free them out. You can't use them, okay?
That's bad. You can't access any of these because we are on a finite little world, right? We're very limited here, okay? We don't have infinite resources coming in. We've got to access those old resources. We've got to be able to use them again. So, herbivore, carnivore, decomposer, or producer? Well, the plant that it's a producer, but the little butterfly, herbivore, right? It's going to take that nectar from the plant, which is highly rich in energy. This guy, I talked about these before, right? Very much a carnivore. How about these mushrooms?
Decomposer.
Okay. So these decomposers, again, we don't really like to think about these guys. We don't really care much about decomposers or scavengers.
We tend to see them as, not useful, okay? A lot of times in early schooling, right, you get the food chain, right, the producer, the herbivore, the carnivore, you're done, right? We don't really talk about the rest of the stuff.
The decomposer, again, as I said, is the most important part, other than, of course, the producer. If you can't access all that stuff again, you're out of luck. You can't make anything new, okay? Remember the first law of thermodynamics. Matter cannot be created or destroyed, okay?
We can't just make more. We can't just magic it out of the air, okay?
Oh, got something. No. Okay? So we gotta get it back. These incredibly important species are how we get it back. If dead stuff didn't decompose, nutrients could not be recycled, and we would fail. Every species on the planet would fail without decomposing.
When they recycle it in the back of the ground or whatever, the gravel and this where you do
no, these are chemicals, right? These are physical atoms, so we're not transferring energy. None of it's lost as heat. We actually keep the atoms, right? So when we burn sugar, we don't get rid of the carbon or the hydrogen, right? Or the oxygen. We turn some into water, some into CO2, right?
100%.
All the nutrients stay, okay? Absolutely. Matter cannot be destroyed. just as it cannot be created. So these decomposers do not destroy any of the matter as they're taking it in.
Okay? They change it into a different form.
Okay, so instead of NO2, it's now N2. They never... NO2. They don't destroy it. They just recycle it. They reuse it. So we're going to look at a place
where we don't recycle. Where you can't recycle. How many people been to England? Anybody? No? I haven't. I wish I would have.
In England, they have these big peat bogs, right? There's peat, and they burn peat to keep warm to the trees. It's all peat. Shaggle moss is peat, okay? These bogs, these peat bogs, okay? This moss naturally releases acid as part of its physiology, okay? It lives just fine in these acidic climates, or in these acidic conditions, not climates, conditions. Other plants and animals, not so much. Most of them have a very difficult time. This acid kills off, prevents bacteria from living in these bogs. How would it do that again?
Let's think about what an acid is, right? Releasing hydrogen ions. Those bacteria, they have protein on the outside. They're not used to being in acidic conditions. So what happens to their protein? Denature. The acid denatures their protein.
Okay. We're going back and stuff. Put it all together. So the nutrients are not recycled because the dead matter does not decompose. So how does the moss get the resources it needs to survive? How does any plant or animal in that area get the resources they need to survive? Well, we're going to look at some of the things that live there. When we harvest peat moss, one of the really interesting things that we see all kinds of preserved dead organisms. We see dead organisms that just never decompose. Really interesting. How about dead people? Because of these acidic conditions, because the bacteria cannot break it down, this man, it was in the 1500s, 1400s, he was strangled to death. You can see the rope. That's the same rope. Dumped in a bog, and in the 60s, I believe, was dug out. This is the condition his body was in when he was dug out. The reason this is decaying, this area, this is what they found first. They found that small portion, didn't cover it up, ran and called the police because they thought the guy had just got killed. They thought they were finding a dead body that was a couple of days old, or maybe a couple of years. Not a couple of hundred, a couple of hundred years old, okay? Mummified, preserved, because of this acid, because the bacteria could not break it down. So they actually covered him back over, and they haven't let bacteria get loose on him. Here, the reason it breaks down here is because the acid kind of got washed away because there was some rain, and the bacteria could come in and start destroying. Okay.
They didn't have salt and stuff back then.
Yeah, they had salt. Oh, I'm sorry.
Did they use that moss or the
wood? So let's think about it. One way that you preserve food is salt. What's another way that you preserve food? We still do it today. Cold. But something that they used back then. How about canning? What do you do when you can stuff? How about pickling?
Pickling, you add vinegar. Vinegar or wine, something like that, right? You add something that's very, very acidic because then bacteria can't grow in it. We can still eat it and we're fine because it's not that acidic to us. But the bacteria, it's too much, okay? Vinegar's a great cleaning material. I mean, you can use vinegar to clean most things because of that acidity.
So they wouldn't use peat moss, probably in case we were bad. But they use things like vinegar, absolutely. They did. They can things, absolutely. Salt was just great because with vinegar, if you put vinegar on meat, what does an acid do on a protein? Denatures it, tenderizes it, rips it apart. So if you pour a bunch of vinegar on your meat, it's just going to be a big glob of goo by the end of the day, okay? It's just going to be just blob, right? Salt, on the other hand, just dries it out, makes it so the bacteria can't live, doesn't destroy the meat, doesn't destroy the protein. So that's why you can do certain techniques with certain things. But hey, more applications for the classroom. I never really thought about talking about that. But yeah, now we understand why we would use salt for meat, why we do those drying, and why we have jerky and things like that, why we use that salt and drain the blood so that we have less moisture for when we apply the salt, and why we would use that. Anyway, back to the bottle. Right. So plants in this environment should probably grow slowly because they have less resources to access. They should find new ways to get nutrients if they want to grow a little more quickly. Got to find a new way. Okay. In fact, take off the S. Bog plants are predaceous. They're predators. Okay. Normal bog plants try and get meat. They try and take down animals. They're predaceous not to try and get energy. All they want are the nutrients. Think about a plant that's predaceous. Think about a plant that's a predator. Fly catchers, fly traps. There we go. There's the fly trap. I'm going to watch a video over in a second. This is a pitcher plant. This is a pitcher plant. How this plant works, extremely slick sides, lots and lots of water at the bottom. What happens is, it smells like nectar. So this fly goes, hey, nectar! Flames. Whoops, too slippery. Into the drink. Nectar gets out. Too slippery to get back up the sides, can't fly, drowns. Now this plant lives in tandem with a spider. It has gone through co-evolution. The spider has evolved to work with this plant. The spider is one of the few that can actually, it can adhesive to the external skin of that plant, okay? It can walk back up. So the spider walks down. Before it gets in the water, makes a little bubble. It makes a little bubble of its web. Get some gas, get some oxygen in there, sticks it on. Actually, it sticks it to its back because they use a totally different system than we do for gas exchange. Sticks it to its back, goes into water. It's now a little submarine, right? It's a little submersible. Goes down and gets the dead fly, drinks it, takes in the nutrients it wants, leaves the body, climbs back out. Okay? Happily climbs back out. So it gets what it wants. It gets the energy from the dead animal. The plant gets what it wants. It gets the nutrients from the dead animal because that animal, that fly, naturally decomposes in there via the bacteria that is in that little puddle of water. So the fly decomposes as normal, and that pitcher plant now has the nitrogen that it needs. We talked about nitrogen in lab, right? How it's normally a limiting resource for plants. This is how it's obtaining it. This plant, that I cannot currently remember the name of, also preys on small insects. What happens is the insect smells a very fragrant pollen, very sugary fragrant pollen. So it lands, and it goes to drink the pollen. These little pods are extremely sticky. They're also very acidic. Leads to massive amount of ace. Very acidic. Should be in this environment anyway. The fly walks up, gets connected to one. Uh-oh, I'm stuck. Another one pulls down. Because remember, even though plants don't walk around, they can still move, okay? They're still capable of movement, all right? We don't necessarily think about that as humans because they're moving at a slower pace usually than we do. This plant can move pretty quickly. It will curl over. It will curl over and start putting more of these sticky adhesive pads on there. It will engulf the prey item in these pads, and those pads, like I said, have some acid in it, and will start digesting the prey item. It'll digest it. It can also use those projections to take in the nutrients. Okay? So, another predaceous plant, we see it really close up. They look like little bulbs of water. They're actually little bulbs of glue, right? Then we get to the Venus flytrap. Going to listen to over one more time because I like this. I really like this light series. It was really good. So let's see where those lights are. So those should stay on. So we can. Okay.
The Venus flytrap. Like the sundew, it makes itself very beautiful, at least to a bug, oozing fragrant nectar across the surface of each leaf. Eating's good here, but any visiting insect had better watch out for these six tiny hairs. This fly doesn't know the game is rigged. If it strikes one of these hair triggers, it can carry on feeding. But that contact activates a 20-second timer.
Okay, so before we go on, how many people remember when I was talking about action potentials? And I said you had to reach threshold. When they trigger this first hair, we're getting a spike in an electrochemical gradient.
Okay? We're depolarizing, but we're not at threshold yet.
This first one gets us almost a threshold, but not, we'll say that's threshold. Almost a threshold, but not quite there. As time goes on, it starts to go down and down and down. But if you strike another hair, it adds back to its threshold, and we get an action potential. We get a sensory statement. We'll see what that statement is.
A second contact while the timer's running, and...
Action.
An electrical impulse is triggered, and the leash snaps shut in a fraction of a second. The tips lock together like prison bars. If the fly is very big, or very small, it may just beat the rat. But most get the death penalty.
The line. Or the setup. Yeah. Eventually.
10 days later, the trap reopens. All that remains is a desiccated hush.
It got
the lad has finished its meal. Once again, sets the table for the next victim.
In just one of that night, all of them. Once I'm done with you, I don't need you anymore.
What happens to the carpet?
Yeah,
it just drops out and then falls out. It doesn't do anything really that active with it. It will have a few different traps, but once the timer's up after it's done that. If it fires and it doesn't feel anything, I think it's, I can't remember how many hours, but it will eventually open again. If it fires and it has something in it, it will stay closed. Once it opens back up, it just lets the wind take the body more heat. It just doesn't care. And flies are not that intelligent. They will fly over and land on the dead bodies there, friends, and not really pay much attention to. So it's not really a big problem for the fly trap. It doesn't, you know, there's no real problem there. Oh, one of my friends died here. Whatever. Not brilliant. They're not exactly brilliant. Hey, Beetlejuice gets them with a magnet. There we go. Okay. Most of the time, well, we track all sorts of different chemical elements, especially carbon, through our ecosystem. Okay, we're always tracking these things. We're worried right now because it seems like CO2 is increasing in the atmosphere. Why would it be increasing? Burning two things. Number one, fossil fuels. Why would this increase the CO2 levels more than they were previous to us doing it? Okay? Well, fossil fuels. Got the ground, right? Want a lake. Fossil fuels are what my brother-in-law goes for, right? Coal. Digs for coal, alright? Oil, okay? We drill for oil. All these are huge portions of carbon that are where? Buried under the ground. That means they've been out of the cycle for a very, very long time. When we pull these things out of the ground and put them back into the cycle, guess what happens? We end up with more carbon in the cycle. For some reason, people don't necessarily think of that. But we're pulling them out of the ground, okay, and we're burning them. We're breaking them up. We're putting them back into the business, all right? We're putting them back in the cycle. That is most certainly going to add to the amount of carbon dioxide that's out there. Absolutely. On top of that, we've got a bunch of carbon in the cycle. What do we do with forests if they're getting away? We burn them. Why is this a twofold problem for this whole situation? What do plants do? They take the carbon dioxide out of the air. What are they also doing when we burn them? They're adding more carbon dioxide into the air. So not only are we preventing them from doing what they should be doing, but we're also adding to the problem.
Positive feedback,
absolutely. But boy, that shouldn't do anything, right? That shouldn't cause any issues. We should just be able to add to it forever. No. These things do add up. They do change how our atmosphere is composed. Why does that matter? Why does it matter at all how our atmosphere is composed? It's what our atmosphere does for us. What does our atmosphere do for us? Well, it's what determines how much sunlight comes in and how much sunlight goes out of the Earth. Okay? Other planets that don't have this atmosphere, what happens on, let's say, Mars during a typical day? A whole day on Mars, all right? Standing outside, it's evening. Unbelievably cold, okay? Unbelievably cold. The sun comes up. There's nothing blocking it. There's nothing bouncing it. All of a sudden, it goes from negative light, I think it's 100, to positive 200. Wow, all right? Big, big change in temperature, all right? We've got this huge scale, okay? On the Earth, how much does temperature fluctuate over the course of a day? Over the course of 24 hours? Well, 20, 50, maybe at most, right? Not 200, 300, right? That's a lot, okay? That's because we retain some of the heat because we have a much thicker atmosphere, okay? We don't just lose all the heat after the sun goes away, okay? The sun is putting this radiation down in, lots and lots and lots of energy, okay? Some of it bounces off when it first hits, okay? A little bit bounces off when it first hits. A lot more comes in. Some of it, a whole lot, is absorbed and warms the planet, okay? Also, some of it is absorbed and turned into energy for us, okay? That sugar from the plant. More of some of it hits the Earth and bounces off. The greenhouse effect.
How many people have ever had a greenhouse? Nobody? Okay. When you have a greenhouse, what you're actually doing is you're trying to keep that heat in.
You're trying to keep that radiation bouncing back inside so that you have a warmer house in there. We designed greenhouses before we had the ability to heat someplace. We use the sun to heat for these plants, okay? This is the same idea. It will come in, hit and bounce back, hit and bounce back. Okay? Keep bouncing back in. As we thicken this, it does bounce a little more off in the beginning, but it keeps a whole lot more in. Okay? That's where the problem. All of a sudden, when we have more of these greenhouse gases, we're bouncing more of the heat back in on us. Okay? That's why this would warm up global temperatures. If greenhouse gases rise, that's what's going to happen. Okay? So, this is basically what I was just saying. Light penetrates Earth's atmosphere. Sun is reflected, goes back into space. Sun is absorbed and re-radiated as heat. Heat has trouble getting out, so it warms the Earth. Think of it like a thick winter blanket. The thicker blanket you have, the more heat you will keep. Makes sense, right? The greenhouse effect is in no way controversial. If somebody says, I don't believe in the greenhouse effect, they believe that the average temperature of the Earth is below freezing. Okay? What they mean to say, and they are saying correctly, is that they don't believe that there's global warming, except we see that global temperatures are rising. What they then mean to say is, well, something will come in. Something will balance us out. We'll talk about that again. That could be. Greenhouse effect and global warming. Okay? Is CO2 increasing in our atmosphere? Absolutely. Absolutely. How about it in the past? We did do ice cores to see correlations between temperature and how much, okay? We can use the oxygen to determine the temperatures. We can actually see the trapped CO2 to determine how much CO2 was in the air at those periods of time. We see that when there's more CO2, we have warmer temperatures. Well, I'll put the graph over. But remember, what we learned Monday. Is this saying that CO2 will always cause, and always cause, a rise in temperature? No. It is saying it is highly correlated. Really well correlated. But is it a causal indicator? But it's a very impressive correlation. Got a good mechanism, makes sense, but it doesn't say one causes the other. There are going to be more than one thing doing it, okay? We can go back 400,000 years with some of these ice cores. We have ice cores that can go back 400,000 years. That's a long time. Do we see this correlation staying up top? CO2 concentration. Down below, temperature
in degrees Celsius. So that's the difference in CO2 temperature difference.
That looks correlated, doesn't it?
They look pretty well associated.
Not perfectly, right? There are some differences, there are some discrepancies, but they're pretty well correlated, right?
What does it mean?
CO2 is increasing. We know it. We're doing it. We're measuring it. We see it. We're also increasing other greenhouse gases. We're producing more methane.
There is always and will always be a greenhouse effect, okay? That bouncing of the heat back in is what makes our planet survivable, okay? One of the first things, if we terraform any planet in space, we will have to add is an atmosphere. We will have to add water and an atmosphere. We're lucky it'll already have water, okay? But we will have to make an atmosphere. We're really, really lucky to have one. So, what do we know? All these things seem to be happening. What don't we know? How much temperature will rise? Will it continue to rise? Will it dead end? What's going to happen? Okay? We don't know for sure. Okay? Are the polar ice caps starting to melt?
Yes, huh? Absolutely. Absolutely.
But are there other things that could prevent us from going into a pretty bad situation?
It could be that plants and algae, there we go, in the ocean could increase their uptake of CO2. They could take in more CO2.
They could, potentially.
If there's more in the air, they might be better breathe.
The thing that we have to remember is, what did I say is a limiting resource for plants?
Nitrogen.
Is that increasing as well with the CO2?
So what would we have to do?
Increase the nitrogen level.
There are people who want to dump large volumes of nitrogen off the coast of South America, okay, to have huge algae blooms that will then pull in huge amounts of carbon dioxide, right?
Sounds like a great plan, right? Except for the whole, you're going to have an algae bloom thing. What happens when we have algae blooms? Everything underneath dies. No more light, no more food, no more oxygen. That's why we haven't done it, okay? We're not desperate enough yet.
It's dangerous. It could be really, really bad. It could be really, really good, though. It could work. It could work.
We could also end up... It could also end up fixing itself.
Oh, boy, wouldn't that be nice.
With increased cloud formation, okay? Because of the warmer climate, we get more clouds. Clouds block out sunlight, bouncing it back into space. Hey, we lucked out.
I don't know if I bet on that, but I'm not a climatologist, so...
What we believe by 2050 is that we'll go up by 6 degrees Fahrenheit at the pole and 2 degrees Fahrenheit at the equator by 2050. That doesn't necessarily seem like much to us, but that is a huge amount. A huge amount. Most species have very limited optimal ranges and don't want this kind of fluctuation. Now, another big problem is the poles going up by 6 degrees. What happens to ice if it's in a place that's over 32 degrees? It melts. All we have to do is break that threshold, and all of a sudden we have a huge problem.
Why is it a huge problem?
Hey, this is Antarctica. It's mostly covered with ice, right? Got a bunch of ice over top of it. What happens? Oh, and remember that ice floats, right? Because it's less dense than water. So we've got a bunch of water on top, and we've got a bunch of water, frozen water, over land.
When this melts, is it going to stay here?
No.
It's going to go into the ocean. What's going to happen if it goes into the ocean?
Water levels will rise. What happens? Where do we humans really like to live? On the coast, right? Coast is the nicest place. Man, we love Manhattan, right? Manhattan will go first. Manhattan, Florida,
London
will go, Venice, Port Venice.
Yeah,
it is. That's why it's already
in trouble.
But all these places that we see as big population hubs, really important places to us, dunk. You can't live there anymore. You can't live there anymore. If you don't care about the environment, that's fine. At least care about your own city that you live in, right? Maybe not Phoenix, right? But New Yorkers should kind of care about New York, right? You would think they wouldn't want to be underwater, right? Same thing with Florida or New Orleans or any of these places that are below sea level. When this water comes flooding in, it's going to fill things up. That's going to be a huge problem.
But hey, right? If it's not hurting me, it's not my problem.
Are the ice shelves freshwater or saltwater?
Saltwater.
Oh.
Now, there are scientists who are saying, hey, plane growth is going up, we're going to cut off this CO2, it's going to be good, we're going to be fine. I tend to not feel as optimistic as these guys.
What just happened? Oh, sorry, turned around. So
there we go. I personally am not that optimistic because of the whole, we're burning forests. We're not actually letting more nitrogen flow into the ocean. Okay, we're not increasing in any way the nitrogen in the ocean. In fact, we're decreasing it by overfishing. Okay, we're polluting the ocean. Okay, I don't tend to think or agree with that opinion. I would love to. I hope they're right. That'd be great. That'd be great. Although we give us humans some feeling of immortality, which would be really bad. But it would be a great way to go.